are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Happy St. Patrick's Week, everybody. This is Michel Nashan, and welcome to It Is More Than Food. And fresh off of the public transportation system in New York City, we have Bill Telepan.
Thank you.
We have the one and only Tony LaCorie. And
thank
we
you.
Have, we all, Kirsten, are you with us?
I am here.
Yay! Awesome.
Oh,
awesome. Okay, so we have Kirsten Tobey from Revolution Foods as well. And today's subject is going to be school and foods, because it is more than food. You know, we all often think of food, and this week, this particular St. Patrick's week, some people are thinking corned beef and cabbage.
I know I am
as well. I have a little bit of Irish heritage there. We're at the fabulous Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you know, I'm sure they're going to have some really great stuff on the menu, but the one thing I do guarantee you will not happen, and I'm perfectly fine with it, is they likely will not have green beer.
No. I won't either.
So. Why put green food coloring in something perfectly beautiful as artisan beer? So, Kirsten, are you going to be drinking some beer this St. Patrick's Day?
We'll see where I end up.
Okay. Well, you'll see where you end up. Well, listen, we're going to be thinking of you, and thanks for making it by phone. So anyway, we really wanted to talk today about the relevance of food to children. I have five kids. Bill has a daughter. Kirsten, you have two children, I believe, correct?
That's right, two daughters.
And Tony, you have how many?
Three children and four grandchildren.
Holy moly, wow. Sis boom bob. And let me tell you something, man. Tony's hot. I mean, she looks really awesome.
She does.
Grandchildren, holy cow. Remarkable. But, you know, there's one thing that is, there's absolutely no question. All four of us are parents. And, you know, when we were young adults, we got married. We knew we were likely going to have families. And when we were pregnant as couples, right, we knew we were going to love these children. But until they're born, you really have no idea whatsoever what they're going to mean to you, right?
Right. It's crazy, yeah.
Right?
I mean,
do we hear some kind of an amen or something there, Kirsten, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's just a remarkable thing. So today we really want to focus on the role that food plays, obviously, in the development of healthy, happy children, the family unit, and all that good jazz. And the fact that in the public school system, millions and millions of kids daily really rely on that system to provide them with some kind of a meal. And two of us being chefs and the others being mothers that care deeply about food, as well as being professionals with educational backgrounds, some international, and reaching out to people through food, I think this is a great group. So what I want to do really quick is just start with some of the bios. Bill Telepan, I hope you guys don't mind. We have two fabulous women guests, and we're going to do men first today, only because Bill's a chef and I'm a chef, and I'm going to favor him. Is that okay with you guys?
All right.
Stick together.
All right, cool.
No worries. We'll come out strong in the end.
I know you will.
You always do. Women
yes,
always do.
Indeed. They win. That's just all there is
That's
to it.
True.
One of New York's first and most acclaimed devotees of green market cooking, Bill, really what I call cooks the talk. He's king of where his ingredients come from, chooses through the lens of quality. It definitely shows in the food that he serves you if you're ever lucky enough to get a table at Telepan. I like to say it this way. Telepan, telephone, television, tell a friend about Telepan.
Nice.
They'll live a better life for it. That'll be 35 cents.
All right.
Anyway, I digress. Bill's style of cooking stems from being a Jersey kid where his family shared hearty meals made with vegetables from their own garden. His mom took pride in serving food influenced by her proud Hungarian heritage, and that passion definitely resonates with my dear friend Bill, one of the most amazing chefs I've ever known. And a quote from him, my mom taught me how to kill a pig with dignity, so I can relate to Bill. the relevance of food and understanding life and respect for those things. It's good. So anyway, he wanted to make his approach accessible to the home cook. He wrote a cookbook inspired by Ingredients, Simon & Schuster, 2004. And then he opened Telepan in 2005 on the Upper West Side. Did very well with the New York Times and then garnered the title of Best Newcomer in 2007 Zagat Survey. Wow. Good stuff. And when not at the restaurant, Bill enjoys spending time with his wife, Bev, and daughter, Leah. And since Leah is a student at PS 87, I think that really helped Bill really get involved as the first chef in wellness in the schools. And Bill will talk about that in a little bit. And then I have Tony LaCorey, who is a very dear friend and a longtime advocate in the good food movement. She provides the guiding vision for the school food-focused team, networking with stakeholders and other change leaders to build collaborative partnerships through school food. Her work today really stems from a successful transformation of children's food options in the New York City school system. What an alligator that was to tackle back at the time. It became an issue, and there were very few people that wanted to wade into that, and Tony didn't wade. She jumped head first. She's a public health nutrition scholar as well as a skilled, experienced facilitator of large-scale institutional change across a variety of sectors. More than a decade ago, she developed the Cook Shop, yay, program, now beloved food and nutrition education program in the New York City school, and connects classroom education and school meals with regional farms. She's a longtime faculty member at Teachers College at Columbia University. Tony works with graduate students to deepen their understanding and engagement with food reform. She's freaking awesome, and that's all there is to it. And then we have Kristen by phone. And Kristen, thanks a million for being on the other end of the phone. The bummer there is that you don't get to like have a glass of wine or beer for us and see the wonderful surroundings of the amazing Roberta's restaurant here in Bushwick. So I apologize to you for that.
I wish I could be with you guys.
You are, and we love you for it. Anyway, Kirsten founded Revolution Foods in 2025 with Kristen Gruce Richmond to provide equal access to healthy food for all school children. Kirsten drives the vision and product experience for the company, overseeing innovation, marketing, human capital, among other key aspects of the business. Revolution Foods serves 200,000 meals daily to youth across 11 states and employs over 1,000 community members.
Kudos, Kirsten.
Really, really awesome. The other thing that's awesome is that Kirsten and Kristen are fellow Ashoka Fellows. I'm an Ashoka Fellow as well, and I had the pleasure of meeting them in France at the 30th anniversary conference. So real social entrepreneurs. And Kirsten's career spanned from teaching and leading education programs here in the States, Latin America, to elevating the scalability of school feeding programs with the United Nations Hunger Task Force in Ghana. And she's just got all these freaking accolades. It's almost ridiculous. I feel like a kindergartner here. She's an Aspen Institute Environmental Fellow, Ashoka Fellow, Mentor for the Women's Initiative Fellowship Program through the George W. Bush Institute, and a member of the Culinary Institute of America's Sustainable Business Council, and just really awesome. So, I mean, if all of you aren't freaking convinced that this is the group of the century around school food, just, you know, turn your radios off now. Anyway, let's open it up by, I want to ask, kind of start it with this notion and this question. I mean, clearly school food is a big issue now. The administration tried to deal with it through the Childhood Nutrition Act. Congress grappled with it. Some of us are somewhat happy with the results. Some of us are bummed. Some people just don't even know about it. But clearly from two angry moms, angry people that their kids are being fed weird stuff in school, to cafeteria workers who are sick of being caught in the middle, some of them excited to be caught in the middle, and then large-scale food service companies, some of whom really want to run with this and some of whom want to run from it. It's a challenge. So I would like maybe, Kirsten, to start with you. Here's something that we've seen as a problem of scalability. It's one thing to get maybe one grade school to either buy locally or put an apple on the table or whatever it might be. How did you guys come to a model that allows you to reach 200,000 kids a day?
Well, I mean, I think when we started 7 years ago, or we actually started talking about the idea of starting this 8 or 9 years ago, and we, from the very early stage, we really focused on wanting to build a, you know, an organization that would increase access to healthy food for all kids. And so we started with access and scale and impact as really front and center in everything that we did. And when we started going around and talking to principals and teachers and school leaders and saying, you know, what's driving your decisions around what you're putting on the table in the lunchroom or in the cafeteria, you know, across the board, people told us there's no affordable and nutritious and fresh option out there. And, you know, especially not one that is compliant with the National School Lunch Program for all of these kids, you know, all the kids that are qualifying for a free or reduced price lunch at school. So we took that to heart and we said, you know, we're going to start by saying it has to be affordable and it has to be scalable. And we make all of our decisions and we've, you know, really grown the organization through that lens of, you know, we saw a lot of efforts that were going on that were very locally focused and very you know, focus on getting one ingredient changed in the school meal program or focus on getting a garden built in a school. And all of those efforts are really wonderful. But what we saw was that a lot of those efforts were happening in high-income communities. A lot of change was happening in high-income communities. And, you know, lower-income communities were continuing to be served the same process, you know, bad quality food because that was all that they could afford that was compliant. So, you know, I think part of it is that we just set out with access and impact as our first goal, and then we've built our supply chain, we've built our menu, we've built our team to be focused around those, you know, those sort of core founding principles.
All right. So now, I want to get back to how you guys do the scale, but Bill, I want to toss to you because you got involved in this because you had a child and you started realizing, wow, I no longer am in control of everything that my child's going to put in her mouth, right?
Right.
That's the deal. Your interest started, I think, before the whole chefs moved to school thing, uh-huh. Right, through the Obama administration.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're now, am I mistaken? Are you in over 20
40.
Schools?
40. 40 schools, yeah.
We're holy cow, that's almost as old as I am.
Yes, you look fabulous. Yeah, I mean, you know, it wasn't so much her. It was my daughter, I always felt, was going to eat fine because I'm a chef. But it was more about, you know, after meeting Nancy Easton, who's the executive director, and a couple of the moms in the school, this is going back when they were just sort of in three schools, it became more about, like, what are the other kids eating? And not the kids that have to eat the free lunch. And that's where it really tears at you the most. And I think, you know, you talk, it's all, there's not a lot available in terms of what the dollar amount is from the federal government after you pay workers and labor and
well, and cleaning supplies, right? And stuff like that.
Yeah, everything goes. That 267 it's now, or maybe 278. Okay. Yeah. We got 6 cents more this past year per child.
Wow.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, think about you running over. I mean, that's the thing it is. It's become, you know, actually more recently, yesterday I was in Miami and I visited a school down there and spoke to a school food worker. And it's really, you talk to her about it. It's like, you know, she's feeding 250 kids and they give them two people to do it. And not only the two people that have to cook breakfast and lunch or have it ready, you know, they're not necessarily cooking anymore, but they also have to count every meal, mark it down that they have every meal cut. They have to clean the place. And this is all, she's the only one who works 8 hours. And then she has somebody who works 3 hours during the lunch hour to do the cleanup. And then she has another person who works 6 hours. So you're talking about, like, you know, two full-time people really doing the job to feed 250 kids two meals a day. And so, therefore, you cut labor down to a minimum. And therefore, since you cut labor down to a minimum, how are they going to actually cook the meals? Well, they cook it by...
They heat them.
They heat them. Serve, right? They open the box and they heat them, right? And so, and you have... How do you make that as cheap as possible? Is you take a pound of chicken, you mix in a pound of something, and then you get 2 pounds of chicken all of a sudden, as you know, which becomes fast food. So now the kids are being served fast food, and it's like is it Kirsten?
Yeah,
said,
Kirsten.
You know,
right.
Kirsten said, you know, in the high income areas, you know, you can have these programs where like a parent comes in or they cook something or they pay extra for, which can be. And what Wellness in the School's main goal is to really is to get into the high poverty schools and sort of and we're in low poverty schools too, but our goals are to be we're in more high poverty to sort of bring these programs so the kids are not only being taught about gardens, which are you know, which is great, and not having classes, but also just eating the food that is, and that's where it really stems from. I mean, I go back and forth. It's the dollar amount that's available, and I think that, you know, we care so much about. I mean, my daughter just called me. That's why I ran out, and she hasn't gotten back to me. I don't know what's going on, and it kills me to know what's going on right now with her.
Right, yeah.
And so we care about our kids so much that, the basic 3 meals a day should be like a high priority. And I think parents are busy. They use the excuse that they're busy. And there are people out there who just can't plan and afford good food. Yeah. And your program's wonderful, making that Wholesome Wave and making that accessible. But I think it comes down to that we have to really somehow – we have to find more money for these kids in the lunch program.
Yeah, I would agree. Now, I know that Kirsten's head is rolling off of her shoulders over this because they deal with some scale here. But, Tony, I want to pitch to you with School Food Focus. I mean, there is a notion that 6 cents, if you source properly, actually can make somewhat of a difference, right? But you guys have been addressing it by looking at changing some of the products that are in this, what I like to call almost like a catastrophic system, when you see some of the stuff actually hitting the plate of these kids. You guys are looking at actually changing some of those ingredients. But if you wouldn't mind indulging us by telling us what's on the typical lunch tray, and then tell us what you're doing it and how you're taking a, because your approach also is one of scalability that tries to deal with the tension that's caused from these ever-shrinking school budgets.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to jump right in when Bill was speaking, even when Kirsten was speaking, to say that our situation didn't happen overnight. I haven't always worked in school food in my professional career, but because I am a public health nutritionist, I have worked on it in it a number of different times, and for the last several years, all the time. But I'd like to go back to before my daughter was born, so early 80s. I was doing some work in the schools and didn't get back again until I started in the cafeterias, really, until she was like kindergarten, first grade, and we were beginning to develop the cookshop program. And I just was stunned by the difference that I found. So those dates are like 80s to into 90, right?
Wow.
94 was when cookshop started. And that's the period during which Reagan came in, really cut the muscle out of so many of these programs, including the equipment, which is a real key, because up until 1980, there was a line item every year in the budgets for cooking equipment. Mm. Food industry steps in with the convection ovens over time that match all this heat and serve, which gets over to what Bill was talking about, so that I think before my daughter was born and I was in the schools, I thought, you know, this is like what we have at home, but I think I do a better job cooking. Not that I'm not a chef like you guys, but I think I do a better job of cooking.
Oh, neither
of these
are we.
When I was back in there for cookshop looking at the cafeterias, it was a brand new world. It was so different than what I had remembered 10 years before. And it was just all this, what I thought then was highly processed stuff. But we're now at a new level of this ultra processed kinds of food products. And so I guess what we've been learning about inside School Food Focus, which is really about systems change, mm-hmm. and trying to understand what it takes to change the systems through which these, in our case, large school districts are accessing food from this food system out there. I mean, school food it's not very different than what people eat across the country because of what the food system is like.
Right.
It's just that the school system concentrates our kids, you know, and so it's palpable. Your heart is, you know, your heart just beats fast when you see all this ultra processed stuff in there. And so we ended up, our early days were like 07, working with, we ran a couple of what we called focus groups, I guess, what came to be called focus groups, but it was 17 school districts that we brought together from across the country who we thought had some idea about what procurement change might look like and what it could be. And 2007 was before Obama. And so at that point, those school food service directors were bashed daily in the papers for this crappy food that they were serving to the kids. Mm-hmm. When in fact, they're part of this larger system. It wasn't intentional. I mean, you can't talk about it like that exactly. And it took us a couple rounds with these districts, and we asked them to bring in their what we called organizational partners, organizations from their communities that they could imagine working with over time on procurement change. And so we went through these two sets of meetings, and the first set of meetings was really tough. Mm. There wasn't...
You were a threat.
Oh.
A perceived threat.
Oh,
right.
Every verb, every word, you know, was parsed. And at the end of it, we came to trust each other, or they came to trust that we were trying to figure something out. And all of them came back 2 months later. We did our homework. And by the end of the next round, we had kind of a shell of what they thought would make sense. And that's really, you know, the last 5 years have been the build out of this shell. And basically, we work, there's now 36 districts and all of their organizational partners. So it's a nice, rich voice. And we work with them shoulder to shoulder, the districts, in trying to figure out food by food category what it is they want to change. And the kind of big broad strokes are that we all feel comfortable talking about are more healthful, more regionally sourced, more sustainably produced. Everybody in focus can say those words without blinking their eyes. And it's not that we can get all of the products at all to have all of those characteristics. But when we do this procurement change work, we dig really deep into the districts, and they identify a small number of foods that are basic foods like chicken, like produce, like milk, like grains. And we work through a process to figure out how to get a more healthful, more regionally sourced, more sustainably produced version of that food.
So I'm going to guess that with that notion, moving from a chicken nugget, which is probably about 40 to 50% corn polymers, not all chicken,
exactly,
to a whole chicken breast, would be a big win.
It's a great big win, and Chicago won it.
Chicago. Hey, I'm from Chicago. I love that.
What's crazy about that is I this woman in Florida, I was talking to the school. She was cooking like chickens. She, like 5-6 years ago, she said. And to your point,
wow,
it sort of became complicated for no reason. And now to get like a chicken breast,
right,
is like you said, I just listening to you talk, to have these meetings to get it to a point where they parse every word and you're like, that's ridiculous, you know.
Yeah, well, it's not
kind
so,
of like, you know, it's kind of nuts when you really think about it.
So,
like,
so Kirsten, I want to talk about your model too, because you're employing 1,000 people, reaching,
wow,
these 200,000 mm-hmm students a day. What's the model? I mean, where does the rubber meet the road, and how have you guys been able to circumnavigate this really ugly field of school budgets that are not growing? I mean, they grew by
six cents
for food. Yeah, I agree. I understand. But I think if we really put into to the context of the labor that we could use, we could spend a lot more money. Kirsten, what are you guys doing to address this and reach so many kids so far?
Well, so what we realized is that, you know, it's changing the whole system takes time. And so what we, you know, we saw the same thing that that, you know, both Bill and Tony are talking about, that, you know, schools are increasingly wanting to just open up a box and reheat something, but generally what they're doing is opening up a box of, you know, processed things that are showing up frozen at the back door and reheating them. And so what we did was we said, well, we want to get fresh food back into the schools. How can we do that? And, you know, I mean, one option obviously is to have people cooking fresh on site at the school cafeteria. the cost and the equipment required for that is obviously expensive, and that's another, you know, that's sort of the next step in shifting the system. But what we saw as a really, you know, viable step right now is that we actually produce all of the fresh food centrally in each of the regions that we operate in. So, you know,
so it's
here
like a, is it like a commissary?
It's like it is a commissary, yeah. So we have a commissary that, you know, we have, and that's why we have 1,000 employees at each of our commissaries. We have chefs and cooks and prep cooks, and we're cooking everything in, you know, fresh every day, and then delivering it every day to school, delivering the meals every day to schools in a format that they can then just, you know, we mostly deliver the meals cold, refrigerated, not frozen. But they're sort of in the same format that a school can take them and just heat them up and serve them. So at the school site, you're not having to really significantly change the equipment or the labor required, but the product that's going, you know, in the back door and into the students' hands at the end of the day is a fresh, you know, it's made within the last day rather than something that's frozen, processed, and shipped across the country. So we've developed our program so that it can fit really well into the existing infrastructure, but it has a significant change in the food quality that kids are experiencing, and, you know, in terms of fresh fruits and vegetables, you know, we cook all of our own rice and beans and pastas and things like that. You know, we're serving fresh soups, and I love what Tony was saying about the supply chain. We've really tried to shift our supply chain, or we have shifted the supply chain, we've built our supply chain, on a few principles of, you know, no artificial anything, no artificial preservatives, no artificial colors, no artificial flavors, and by doing that, you're sort of forcing the supply chain to become a more fresh supply chain, and then we also have, you know, our nutritional parameters and wanting to make sure that the food is healthy and has whole grains, and, you know, we're serving fresh fruit, not canned fruit, and all those kinds of things that are pretty simple, you know, basic nutritional steps to take. But obviously, from a food system standpoint, a lot of these things have been kind of, you know, slowly eked out of the system, and we're trying to get them back in through our model. And the model of daily fresh delivery is one that allows us to keep a lot of fresh, you know, we basically turn over our inventory, you know, every day, and so there's, you know, we can keep a lot of fresh food coming in and going out the door.
That's awesome. So in many ways, it sounds like what you've done is you've kind of pulled some of that activity upstream. You're almost like a shared services model, and actually part of the supply chain. And you know, Bill was saying, first of all, there, you know, to go into 40 schools with chef leadership is huge. You know, with school food focus, getting fresh chicken breasts and other ingredients like that.
Drumsticks.
Say again?
Drumsticks.
Oh, drumsticks? Oh, forgive me. I am a dark meat guy, by the way.
With you.
But yeah, okay. Well, but still, you know, all of this stuff, though, truly is possible because there is this tension and there's this realization that what's there has to change. But we do have, I mean, just some statistics. We have close to 160,000 public schools in the United States, right? If we took those schools and figured somewhere an average to $50,000 to $100,000 of infrastructural investment in each school to actually get the schools to a point where they could do the roast chicken that this woman is doing in Florida, and all schools in the United States cook fresh food from scratch, that's tens of billions of dollars in infrastructural investment.
Yeah.
It's a big number.
It's a big number.
Right? Now, and then if we do that, so I'm putting on the hat of a school food service company. If we do that and we actually expect food to be cooked from scratch, we're going to have to hire what? You know, two more full-time, or take two part-timers, make them full-time, add some staff, right? We're going to have to add some staff. We say 1.5 staffers is, even per school, that gets into the billions of dollars per year.
You can typically add one more person in New York City schools that are cooks. And in New York City, you have, I think, 1,600.
Well, because the budget allows, or can add.
Well, that's
because they have room in the kitchen.
It's not part of the federal program.
Right. Okay.
And then, and so, but if you added one more person per school, I think I did the math one time. You end up somebody, and but beyond that, you have all these kids being generated out of these culinary schools right now who are either not finding work or they're, you know, they could go get a job in a kitchen like mine and get.
Well, you guys are actually deploying some of these kids.
Yes,
going to culinary
right. So
schools,
you
right?
can hire these kids who are coming out of culinary school. There's, we've. Let me just keep going, and then
please
so
do.
You end up having you. Yeah, and you get, the offer is this: is like, you know, you can make $35,000 a year. You can get benefits. You can get you get 2 months off a year. Would you want to take that job? Meanwhile, while you're working from 7 to 3 or so, or your 8 hours in your day, can you go and then you could go cater or do whatever you want. The one program we talked about with some people in the government in New York City is doing a kind of a program where it's a 2-year program, kind of like you know, ROTC. You know, these kids' culinary schools cost $40,000-$50,000 a year now, and some of the programs are 60 are 6 months. So you're jamming all this money on there and all debt to them. Is there a way that you can sort of employ these kids to come in, help them pay their college loans back, and sort of do a service to the community? The other idea, though, is I've seen Rev's food stuff out in Newark, and it's fabulous.
That's,
you know,
shorthand for Revolution Foods there.
And it's another idea, you know, so you can sort of just create and say, I'm just using New York as an example. You create a commissary in each of the boroughs that can sort of bring in better product, right? That can get processed by school food has a chef in each borough. They're in charge of it. And they create, say, a chili that can be sort of come from grass-fed food. Doesn't have to be organic, but let's say grass-fed. Because then you drive a market for grass-fed, right? And now that price drops some. But, you know, if you really look at, you know, and you're not serving it every day, but you're looking at getting better products that – I'm not even asking them to go buy the chicken I buy for Telepan. I'm asking them to go buy the chicken from Purdue, but it's fresh. Let's start from the basic element where it's just mm-hmm. like you cook it somehow and you mm-hmm. add the ingredients to it somehow. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you're looking at with School Food Focus, right? It's
yeah.
like how do we get more raw whole foods into this equation?
Yeah, yeah. And part of it is part of it is like changing the culture inside schools and what's possible.
Yes, that's important too, right?
So when we started one of these early learning labs, great food service leader in St. Paul, great, great. And she was unwilling to go with the cooking of the chicken because it was, for her, it was a food safety issue. And okay, I get it. It's a food safety issue for you because her people have not cooked chicken in how long? It was a long time. And what she did was involve herself in our discovery process, interviews in the supply chain, going out to the field, talking with people, et cetera, et cetera. And she ended up realizing by the end of it that the only way she could get clean chicken was to buy it fresh or fresh frozen.
She was going
to have to learn. She's going to have to teach her people how to cook. And that changed her, and she's been cooking chicken ever since.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me because as I listen to the three of you, the one thing that I hear in common by the common sense of the business aspects of this is that somewhere along the line, this could be a job creation opportunity.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So we could either look at adding a cafeteria worker to each school as a drain on the school budget, or we could look at it as an opportunity to reduce unemployment. If we hired a school cafeteria worker
from the community too,
per public school, if we added a cafeteria worker, that would create tomorrow about 160,000 jobs.
Yeah,
right.
There you go.
That's pretty interesting stuff.
Right. I mean, you could go to the infrastructure about, but again, like it's it's like teaching them how to cook now, and equipment issues. You know, when I was putting together the recipes for Wellness at School, I was doing it out of a cafeteria that had 2 convection ovens, a steamer, and one flame. With the idea
fun.
That some of the schools do not have the tilt skillets, some of the schools don't have burners. And even if they have burners, the schools that I've gone in with burners, they don't have the pot big enough to create chili for 600 kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about that, right? If you don't have the tilt skillet, then you go to the stove, so you have to use the convection oven. So it's a matter of the powers that be sort of being more creative and sort of thinking outside the box, and culture in both ways, inside the schools through the kids, teachers, principals, parents, and also the people who are in charge of feeding the kids. It's just that feeding kids aren't that important to people.
Or because it's hidden. So it's interesting because it's, you know, we're in a life of busy parents, and before we wrap up, I want to pose a couple of notions. One is, you know, people are working two and three and four jobs to make ends meet. You know, so often the pressure isn't there because they just feel their kid, they trust their kids are going to be okay when they go to school. But when we come back, I want to really ask the question of, you know, do we look at rebuilding all that infrastructure in the schools, or do we look at the role that the investment community might play in creating the types of facilities in the five boroughs or in or outside of Newark where we can actually create thousands of jobs to help kind of do what Kirsten is doing by providing better foods almost ready to eat and making it easier on these companies to accept a changing what's in the supply chain. So as we get ready to close, I'd like us to think about that when we come back on.
Bingo.
Never had no loving like this before. And I just want to testify that you, yeah, you made me feel so good inside. Never had no loving like this before.
You're listening to Lovin' Like This by the California Honey Drops on It's More Than Food, heritageradionetwork.org.
You felt it too. But oh, yeah, you're trying to keep it on the low. But now babe, I saw it in your eyes that you ain't never, 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 never had no loving like this before.
Well, now, everybody, welcome back to It's More Than Food. I am Michelle Nashan of Wholesome Wave and Dressing Room Restaurant, and we have three amazing guests with us today. If you were with us earlier, we're talking about how to unlock the code of feeding our kids better at school. We kind of left with what the challenges are, what some of the existing problems are in the three great models that Bill, Kirsten, and Tony presented earlier. But, you know, moving into this, there's no question that we have millions of kids eating breakfast and lunch every day. We have hundreds of thousands of public schools feeding the children, all of whom are on these extremely tight budgets. Some of the models that we see that are getting some traction are having success because of the pressure that parents are causing. The current administration has made nutritious school food a huge issue. Tom Vilsack, Secretary of Ag, talks about it all the time. What do we think about the opportunity of pushing some of this stuff upstream? You know, there's a lot to be said for changing what's in the pipeline of the supply chain. If we could look at re-regionalizing the way the food is actually produced, there could be a role that local and regional mid-sized farmers could play in feeding fresh food into the system and creating jobs and facilities that could actually accept financing, pay those loans back with interest, contribute to the economy, hire people. Do we see value in pushing some of this work upstream instead of doing it right in the school? Or do we really want that closeness of having the cafeteria workers cooking from scratch? I want to start with you, Bill, because you mentioned the woman in Florida with the roasted chicken.
It's, you know, whenever I get that question posed to me or think about talking about, it's just so big and complicated and tangled. You know what I mean?
No, wait, because which part of it is big and entangled? Pushing it upstream, having the people do it in the school?
No, and I think when you talk about who is involved, like the Aramarks and the Chartwells and those people that are involved now, and then Purdue or Tyson and those people and the corn industry and the soy industry. I mean, it's not – I mean, if you could – you know, like when – and, you know, and I know they throw those – I mean, it's there, you know? I mean, it's not as simple.
Well, they have the contracts. It's wrapped up. There's a lot of money at stake.
I could say, you know what? I'm going to go out to some people and say, I need $50 million to build 5 facilities in New York City. It's going to create 500 jobs. We're going to produce food for the New York City school system with the Department of DOA, with the regulations, using fresh food, doing what they're doing, like at Rev Foods and Revolution Foods. Sorry, I know you want to sell the brand.
I like Rev Foods.
That's Telepan Restaurant. 72 was no. But you want to be able, I mean, you have to sort of weave that. So I think it can be easy to do. And I don't know what the right, I love the idea of having that person in the cafeteria who can talk to the kids. You still may have that ability if you did a centralized kitchen or, you know, and then that, but the whole food goes out. So I like that idea a lot. I mean, I like both, you know, because you can, and on the other hand, where you have the extra worker in the kitchen who can possibly work with the current infrastructure that you have and maybe not make it so, not every kitchen in New York City needs to be redesigned, you know. Mm. Maybe half the kitchens need to be redesigned. And they're building new schools or they're doing renovations in schools. So it's the budget may be there. So the fact that you have a one person, an extra person in the kitchen cooking it is great. But it goes, Tony mentioned this before about food safety. That's a huge, huge issue, especially when you're feeding 1,500 kids. If you get in fresh chicken and this one right. person doesn't cook it long enough, you know, I mean, you got to give credit where credit's due. So if New York City, you feed 1 million kids a day with $1 and nobody gets sick. I mean, you could look at it that way. But, you know, they don't get sick now.
Exactly.
Mm. Right. You know what I mean? What does it look like down the road? That's an interesting argument, because I would say on the investment side, going out and raising $50 million to build the facilities, if the demand and the pressure of the demand is there, I think there are investors that would say, I'd love to be the guy who was able to go into an arena of consumer demand and beat out Tyson and beat out Aramark. Or let Aramark become a customer of a newer alternative system, right? That opportunity is there. I do believe that. Now, Kirsten, you guys have kind of done that in a way. I mean, you're doing whole meals. Are you doing everything? Or are you just doing add-ons that are getting added onto the tray? Talk a little more deeply about the model. And then I have a couple of questions for Tony when it comes to actually working with these Leviathan companies.
It's fun.
Yeah, so we are doing the whole meal. We do the, you know, the center of the plate, the protein, the grain, the vegetables, the fruit, the milk.
All in.
In some cases, with some school districts, they have their own milk contract, so the milk is not, you know, we're not making the milk, obviously. So there are times when we'll do, you know, just the entree or just the, you know, just a part of the meal. But mainly we're doing the real, you know, center of the plate, breakfast, lunch, after school snack. Now, you know, increasingly schools are starting supper programs. And I think back to your original question, which was, you know, can sort of the school food, the volume that schools are going through in terms of, you know, the number of dollars that are being spent on food, does that have the power to change the supply chain and to really move the needle? I think, yes, it does. I mean, it absolutely does. But the issue is that the whole movement needs to be aligned. And I think this is something that Michael Pollan has talked a lot about, is that the problem with the food movement is that it's very fractured. You know, you have your local people, you have your sustainable people, you have your nutrition people, you have your, you know, there's all these different people with agendas that could be more aligned. And and so I think that there's, you know, if you look at whatever you think about the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act that you know got passed through Congress in the last couple of years, the thing you have to really remark at the fact that, you know, last year the School Nutrition Association show, which is this, you know, I'm sure you guys have been to it, if not heard about it. It's this, you know, gigantic trade show of all of the processed foods that you can.
I can't wait to
the
get
world,
there.
All trying.
You
to
haven't
get
been
sold
yet.
Into school food districts, and you know, last year was the first year. All of a sudden, everybody was talking about whole grain because all of a sudden it was a requirement, and you know, nobody would have ever been talking about whole grain at that trade show if it hadn't been for, you know, this regulation coming in and saying now we need to have, you know, some percentage of our grains need to be whole grain, and of course it's not going far enough, and of course there's still, you know, there's whole grain processed corn dogs with all kinds of artificial ingredients in them. But I think, you know, when you think about system change, you have to kind of think about how can you do it one step at a time, and so I think if there were more, and also you have to think about how to keep the school leadership sort of stakeholders happy in what they're doing. And so I think, you know, one of the things that we've heard over and over from school leaders and superintendents and, you know, even food service directors is that they don't have the capability or the budgets or the equipment to be running a restaurant on site. And so nor do they want to be worried about food safety and these sorts of things. And so I think, you know, thinking about what are the sort of small steps that we can take, and of course, you know, from a regulatory standpoint, now, you know, multiple colors of fruits and vegetables is coming in, and I'm sure that, you know, sales of butternut squash have probably gone up nationwide because of, you know, because you have to serve orange vegetables one day a week, and you know, the number of whole grains that are now at least getting onto the plates in schools across the country, you know, those are small steps, of course. But, you know, I look at what San Francisco Unified School District did recently, where they said, we're tired of bringing in frozen food. We want to bring in fresh food. And they, and wow, you know, that was the
and that
know,
was,
requirement
and
that,
that
they
and,
put out there.
And that was the district speaking.
That was the district. It was the food service director and the superintendent and the you know, health and wellness committee getting together and saying, what's a step in the right direction that we can take? Yeah. And so, you know, they said, you know, we're tired of getting frozen food that's shipped across the country to, you know, get served to our kids every day
this
city that's, you know, the foodie capital of the West
Coast. Yeah, you know, that's amazing,
you know,
to me.
We're talking to New Yorkers there.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. What's funny to me is you talk about this color thing, and that's really intriguing to me, as long as they don't allow them to serve green beer. That's, you know, no green beer. Don't add food coloring. As long as it's natural orange. Now, Tony, I wanted to get over to you, and then I have a couple of Twitter questions that I want to bring out real quick, and then I want to just kind of hold up Ann Cooper's recent book, The Famous Lunch Lady. But you're dealing directly with some of these large scale purveyors. Yes. No.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And tell me what the mood is there around this issue. I see it as kind of some want to embrace it, some want to run from it. What are you finding in your work?
I think, like everything else, it depends on the company. It depends on where the company is working. If you look at the school districts across the country, or even the school districts that we deal with, the large ones, all of them aren't wanting more healthful, regional, sustainably produced foods. But we're trying to work with the ones who do, so maybe we'll call them the early adopters.
Okay, so not throwing anybody under the bus, who do you really dig right now in this match, so to speak?
In terms of companies?
Who really is showing you that there's a promise that some of these larger companies are coming to the table?
There was a visionary. 10 years ago, I would not have said this, but given the Chicago experience we had, there was a visionary, a guy inside Chartwell's. Mm. He made it possible to get that chicken in. And I'm sure he had to fight the fight inside that company, but he did it. And so we have the concrete example of it really being possible. Can you just make that vision happen across the country? No, it's different from school district to school district, company to company. And I think that's as we transition, and we are transitioning, that's what you have to watch for, because it's going to take the will of the people and powers connected to school districts to make these kinds of changes that have to take place. So when Kirsten talks about small steps, I think you said, or I was thinking incremental to whatever language you were using. And I think that's just so important, because these districts have been locked in, these schools have been locked in this model of heat and serve for all the reasons that we've talked about. And so to break from that model and to go from to something else, you really have to know and work with them about what steps are possible to change. San Francisco could do what it did. Other districts, Cleveland, won't go in that direction probably, but they can take steps that make sense to them, and that's what you have to watch for.
Well, and it's interesting, because it's a tough row to hoe for these companies, because they have literally tens of thousands of employees, right? And when you look at changing from a chicken nugget to a chicken leg, a new standard operator procedure has to be written. I mean, there is huge, it seems like a tiny, tiny, tiny step. But then I guess on the other side is, when you do get a company like that to move from a processed food to a fresh food, it's kind of like when Environmental Defense did the deal with McDonald's about a decade ago to take antibiotics and growth hormones out of 25% of their meat supply. A lot of people were deriding Environmental Defense, saying, oh my God, how could you do that? That's not enough. But you're talking about a couple of million metric tons of antibiotics and hormones coming out
and
of the supply.
They are better positioned to do that than the school districts are. And it's not that the school districts can't change or that they can't change, but the process of change has to fit with what the systems are. So the districts are just going to be a little slower than the big guys. But I'd like to get over to your question about upstream and investment. I think it's kind of a both and answer, in that the schools need investment on their equipment for sure. And I'm not saying that every school in the country has to have a full cooking kitchen. That does not make a lot of sense to me, given where we are. But investment strategically can be placed in the districts, and investment can also be placed in the supply chains out there, so that food can be aggregated and processed ready to go into the schools and to the other institutions, our other public institutions, so that we can support the mid-sized farms out there.
Well,
those are the folks who are really struggling.
And that's interesting, because those mid-sized farms are in every state in the country.
That's right. That's right.
They've been dubbed specialty crop growers, like somebody threw some kind of like, you know, agricultural holy water and said, you're a specialty crop grower, even though we're supposed to be eating five servings.
And the schools
are
very special too, right? We're all special here.
Amen. We're all special. You know, but it's interesting because, you know, Bill, especially with your fan of local and sustainable, and we actually have a question from Derek Rodenizer, and he asked, you know, what's the key factor to achieving sustainability involving local food in schools? The whole notion is, you know, if you look at the agricultural regions, not just in the state of New York, but, you know, Massachusetts, Western Mass, New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, we're kind of like the Northern California, the East Coast. I think the opportunities to strategically locate these types of facilities in a way that could really become a boon to those agricultural economies while supplying. And I agree with you, Tony, there's got to be some kind of a dovetail in the infrastructural investment in the schools to accept
this
new product.
Yeah, the schools have been stripped,
right?
The schools have been stripped, right.
Stripped, that's a good word. I was thinking of another word, like raped or something. It just, I've seen some of these cafeterias. They're ridiculous. It's unbelievable. But I mean, that's got to appeal to you somewhat, Bill, right? It's like a regional value-added processing facility that provides, I'm guessing, I don't know, 1,000 jobs and can reach, two or three dozen school districts.
It's 100 jobs, but it's still taking food from New York State. I mean, I was at this conference 3-4 years ago at Alfred State about how do you get these Western New York farmers into New York City. I mean, that's a terrific way. I mean, that was part of my sort of role, was not only to help them sort of connect to restaurants, but also to connect, how can they connect to the school district? I mean, Valdorp Foods, they're located in New Jersey now, but supply a lot of the New York City restaurants. They were, I don't know what happened with it, but I know they were talking to School Food about creating a romaine processor that would take the local romaine, and they use tons of the stuff in the city, to just chop it up, get it washed and ready, so they could just bag this stuff that's been sort of taken out quickly and then put into the schools.
Yeah.
And it's all local, you know. But if I don't think it happened for whatever reason. Maybe it
costs
too much, but it's a great idea to take that investment that way too.
And there's a model. I mean, you know, Bob Lewis, great guy, you know, co-commissioner of agriculture, state of New York.
Bob, I think, was involved in
that. Yeah. Well, you know, he's the guy who did the whole sliced apple thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we grow all these apples in New York. You know, why are, if there are apples at all in schools, which at the time there weren't many at all, but if they were, they came from Washington State. He's like, for God's sake, this could be direct business support for New York State. Brilliant guy, doing some really neat stuff. So I think, and Kirsten, you guys actually have that protocol. Don't you deal a lot, as much as you can, with local and regional farmers?
We do. I mean, I think as we look at how we prioritize what we do, obviously getting nutritious fresh food into schools is our first priority. And you know, in the regions that we're working in, you can't always do that with purely local and regional sources. What we have done though is, you know, when we have found great suppliers in a region that we work in, we've really tried to help them to scale up with us. And, you know, we've given them access to other markets. Like, I always think about this this rice farmer that we work with here in Northern California, because we grow a lot of rice in Northern California. There's a lot of water issues there, but that's the state of the state here. There's this amazing rice farmer that our executive chef, Amy, met at a farmer's market, tasted this rice. It's this, you know, really great brown rice. It's a little bit lighter than what you typically think of as a brown rice, but still, you know, high in fiber, and it is a real brown rice. And she said, we've got to get this into our schools. So we started serving it in our schools in Oakland, and then we started buying that rice for our schools in L.A., and then we started using it in our schools in Colorado and Texas and, you know, in places where you can't buy rice locally. So it is a local product that we use here in California, but we've also now given this rice farmer access to this, you know, this entire Western market, so that he's been able to grow his business.
That's so cool. Now I have another question, and I'm going to toss this right back to you, Kirsten, because we have a New York farmer said to me, when will schools welcome tasty, nutritious whole milk? You were talking about some of the milk contracts that you guys don't get involved with, but what are you seeing in terms of kind of local and regional school milk? And I'm going to ask you the same question, Tony, so when Kirsten's finished, if you could do the same thing. I always wonder what the hell happened to whole milk. This 1% thing just makes my head fall off. I have two children with diabetes. All nutritionists say your kids really should be drinking 1% or no fat milk. They drink whole milk and they're doing great, and it really does not impact their glucose readings. I'm finding when they take it in the context of a whole healthy diet, whole milk is pretty nutritious stuff. What's going on with the milk scene in your system?
Well, so there has been a big push, you know, by USDA and with the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act to have school food, you know, be required to serve non-fat or low-fat milk. And, you know, I think that there certainly is a place for whole milk in a really well-balanced diet. And I think what the issue is that in our society, and especially in communities where, you know, there's not a lot of access to fresh and healthy food, what there is a ton of access to is food that's really high in fat and saturated fat. And so if you add whole milk on top of you know, a diet that's already high in fat, then it just adds additional saturated fat to your diet.
Yeah, so in other words, it would be great to actually have really healthful food in school so that we could serve whole milk. Tony, what do you think about that?
Well, can I ask real quick, what's the percentage of fat in whole milk? Isn't it like 3 or 4%?
No, I think it's high.
Is it higher?
I think it's higher.
Yeah, it's like 12.5%, I think. Okay. Yeah, it's up there. Would be great to get that answer if New York farmer would tweet me back. I'm guessing they're a dairy farmer.
I'm Googling it right now.
Oh, awesome.
Thanks,
yay.
Kirsten. Thanks.
Consult the Google.
Right. This just reminds me of the fact that we really need to deal with where the schools are right now. And one of our pieces of dairy work was to do something about the fact that the dairies would not reformulate their flavored milk with 31 grams of sugar altogether in those 8-ounce boxes.
Yeah, that's nutty.
That's really horrible. And so to even reformulate that down to 21 grams, it took polling across the state of Minnesota to show that dairy that there is a market for a better milk product.
Wow. Well, you know, as always with It's More Than Food,
yeah,
we're frickin' running out of time.
and
what I want to do, first of all, you know, Bill, Kirsten, Tony, I'm such a huge fan of all three of you, your beloved friends, and really fellows in this work. And I want to thank you for taking the time to come to us this St. Patrick's week. So I'm
sorry,
wishing...
Whole milk says here it contains usually between 3.25 and 4.4% fat.
Oh, for the love of God. Splitting hairs over 1.5%.
That's the milk fat, and it's 23% of your recommended daily allowance of saturated fat.
Right, got it.
Thanks, Kirsten.
Yeah, amen. Well, thanks for putting that into perspective. But, you know, still, it's so funny because I've learned a lot about this stuff. You know, if you're eating really great local fruits and veggies and you're eating whole grains and you're getting good quality proteins, saturated fat ain't so bad. You know, it's when everything else that you're eating in the meal has it. So anyway, I did want to hold up before we split what I'm going to start establishing as a tradition on It's More Than Food is really holding up some really cool books. So since today's topic is school lunch and breakfast, Ann Cooper and Linda Holmes did Lunch Lessons 2006, HarperCollins. I love Ann. She has been fighting the fight for an awfully long time. One of the smallest human beings I know, with probably the highest level of TNT of any individual I've ever known. And I wish I could have had you on the show today. Love you. Love your book, Lunch Lessons 2006, HarperCollins. Listen, you know, I saw school food 20 years ago. I saw it 10 years ago. I saw it 5 years ago. I'm watching the needle move, and the needle is only moving because of three of the individuals that could join us here today, and I just applaud you guys' work. I don't know if you want to take a quick parting shot about something that an everyday mom or school superintendent might be able to do. You know, 20 words or less, go, Bill.
Educate yourselves about food, and you'll be able to sort of educate your kids about it better.
Kirsten, your shot.
I would say read your nutrition labels and ingredient panels and try to figure out what anything you don't understand is.
Yeah, and maybe not do that, right? If you can't understand it, don't consume it, something.
If you can't understand it, don't eat it.
Tony?
There you go.
Your parting shot.
I'd say change is really possible, and we're going to feed those kids well. It's going to happen. It's on the way.
That's amazing. Unbelievable. Well, listen, for all of you that are listening out there, thanks for joining It's More Than Food. We'll be back next month. Have no idea what the subject is, but watch the website, watch the blog, follow us on Twitter, all that good jazz, and just keep on listening, and thank you for being part of the show. It's More Than Food. I'm Michelle Nashan. Happy St. Paddy's Week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.